Well, John Lyons, you're here to find out about a great American. I guess I'm American. I'm German and fought in World War I, so I should be an American. And I made love to the German girls over there and almost married one. So I know I'm American, because you know these Americans are great lovers. Well, anyway, going back to my childhood days, we didn't have any money, but we sure had a lot of horses and cows and chickens and what have you. We had lots of fun in our younger days. My brother and I, Edgar, who is still living, very active, we played jokes on the whole neighborhood. If anybody lost any watermelons, roasting ears, grapes, peaches, get the Wally boys. We'd come up, we'd make a clean confession. The dad says, I'll take the boys home and whip them. Never once did he whip us. He says, it deserved them right. The greatest prank we ever pulled off was pulled off against Mr. Von G. I'll say, I don't want to mention his name because he still has children living. We bought a wonderful Surrey. A Surrey is a four-wheeled buggy, and it has little yellow tassels all around it. We had these two big black horses that were pulling the Surrey. We went to a dance at Rudersville. So Mr. G, Von G, he'd always scores one better. He bought a phaeton. A phaeton is the way you sit up high, you drive the horse on a high seated thing. Well, they can't see my arm. Then the front wheels are small and your rear wheels are much larger. So we decided we'd play a joke on Mr. G, my brother and I, and two, three other boys in the neighborhood. We went out and took the front wheels off of the phaeton and put him on the rear of the phaeton. So when he came out of the dance, why, he told my George, he says, George, what's the matter with my phaeton? Look at that phaeton, it's broken. Dad says, well, no, somebody just changed wheels. So he and Mrs. G got in that thing. They couldn't see the horse because they were sitting way down and the dashboard was up above their head. So they followed us home and he couldn't make a right turn or a left turn. So Edgar and I, every time we came to a turn in the road, and there were 90 degree turns, we had to get in the back and lift the phaeton around so he could go home. One of our greatest pastimes was when we come home from school. We'd go to school in the morning, we'd take a bushel of wet corn cob and we'd soak them in the creek. And then we'd have these long willow, and the most time they were persimmon limbs. We could put the end of a cob on them, and you could throw it about 150 yards or so. It was heavy and wet. And on the other side of the creek, the poor little Negro boys, they would go to their school, and they would do the same thing. So we'd have a fight every afternoon after school. And when one of those corn cobs hit you, it was Daisy who blew out the light because it knocked you down. They were so heavy with water. Well, we, as a rule, we had more corn cobs than the little Negro boys because my brother would run ahead of us. He could outrun all of us. And he'd steal half of their corn cobs. So when they got them down, we just left them about 15. We had about 4 to 5 corn cobs. So that wasn't even battle, but it was a lot of fun. And you talk about playing with Negro boys and stuff. Now, this was way back in 1905. We used to play baseball, and on our team, we had 4 Negro boys on there. And we never did have any trouble at all. The only trouble is, we always tried to bat for them. We didn't want them to bat because we told them we could bat better than they could. The trouble was, they could hit so much harder than we would, and they would break our bats. And we had to make our own bats, and we made them out of willow trees and cottonwood trees. So they would swing too hard and break those bats. Well, after that, then I worked for Mr. J. Wessels at Halstead, Texas. He had a general store. When I mean general, it was general. He had a store, he had the post office, the lumber yard, he had the saloon across the track, and he had the cotton gin. I was 14 years old, so I had to run down and weigh a bale of cotton, and then I had to run across the street and sell 5 glasses of beer, then come across and write out a money order, and then go ahead and pick out the only cloth we handled was calico and lawn. The Negroes would come in, they'd buy this calico, and I'd have to buy Mr. Tatting to put on it. These two boys looking at me funny and they said, what is tatting? They don't know what tatting is. Now, I doubt whether the girls know. Your girls know? They don't know what tatting is. It was what you put around there to make the dress look pretty. So I did all of those. I prescribed for them. The Negroes would come in and say, Georgie, he says, Mandy's been real sick and she's just been upheaving. So when I found that out, I said, all right, here's the best thing to give her. We just had one prescription. That was black draught. It was a laxative. So we'd always give them black draught. We'd charge them 35 cents for a box of lax draught. And they'd come home, go home. Next day they'd come back, and as a rule, Mandy was a whole lot better. That's been years and years ago. I remember our biggest sale used to be to hang out the mail bags, and the MK&T would come by. They had that hook on their mail car. It would come by and jerk that mail sack out of there, and they'd go on. And then at nighttime, when it come back, it would stop there, and we would buy bananas and stuff from they call him a butch boy on the train. You all never heard of a butch boy either, had you? Yeah, they call him. You could buy anything you want there. Funny papers or newspapers or just whatever you want. But boy, they had him in those days, the butch boy. Well, from there, then I went on to Thorndale, Texas, and I worked in a grocery store there. I was a general. I did a little of everything. That's where I met my wife. And but before meeting her, I was called to war. I went down to Eagle Pass, worked in a hotel there, and had a side job at Western Union. And for my board, I worked at the Merchant's Cafe. And the night clerk, I got to sleep there for about 3-4 hours a night. So it was a rather strenuous life, but I had a lot of fun with it. And I met a lot of people. For example, I rode in a plane with Jimmy Doolittle, and he dove under the Devil's River Bridge and liked to scare me to death. Terry Allen, who's a general now, used to come in, and even if he hears this, he'll admit he's right. He was with the 7th Cavalry. He'd get all tooted up, and I'd help put him to bed. So, Nora, Terry, if you ever hear this, you know it's the truth. And from there, I went on to war, went overseas, and I enlisted in the 36th Division, and I was a gunner. So they wanted to make me a sergeant, and then I had a chance to make a lieutenant, but I didn't want to do it. I wanted to be a gunner, and I was a gunner during the war. After war, I did a little MP service in Germany, and I had a lot of fun there because there were four of us boys, Elliot Lawrence, my wife's cousin, and Lenny Smith and Dick Short. We were doing MP duty, and we had free meals out at the post, but we wouldn't go out to the post to eat. We wanted these little German girls to wait tables on us, and it just cost us 35 cents a piece. So they would go around the table. I could understand everything they were saying, and they'd go around the table and they'd talk about us. And this one little girl, this one particular night, beautiful little blonde, she said, I wouldn't mind going out with this little fella if he'd asked me to go out with him. So I thought, well, I'll get you then when we get ready to pay. So we tipped him just a dime. We didn't have much money. So then when I got up, go out, I asked in German, wollen Sie heute Abend mit mich rausgehen? Do you want to go out with me tonight? She said, ach, du lieber Gott, oh my dear God, and she liked to fell over. Don't tell the other boys, but they made some rather remarks about these other boys, so I couldn't tell them. I said, all right. So I went out with her, and I had 6 dates with her, but I never would go out with her alone, because she would take me to her father. When I get over there, we'd play dominoes, and then Mama would bake kudalachin for me, and we'd play dominoes until 11 o'clock. I'd say goodbye or something like that, and that was about it. Cut it off for me. Now I'm home. That is after the war, yeah. And I got mad. Just before I went to war, I was at the Eagle Hotel, a night clerk, and the little town across the river was named C.P. Diaz, and then they changed the name to Pedras Negras, which means Black Rock. They had no street. So Beck Bress, who was the mayor of Pedras Negras, came over and asked Mr. Harper if he would allow 12 American boys to compete in bullfights against 12 Mexican boys. Mr. Harper said, well, we will if these boys will have nerve enough. So they asked for volunteers, and I don't know why I volunteered, but a good friend of mine did, Ellis Bonnet, who's an ambassador to Sweden, he volunteered, so we volunteered. And we were trained for 6 weeks. Then we had, this was 1914 and 15, I think. So we had two bullfights then. And then after those two went to war, of course, went overseas. And right after I got back, I got married and then had another bullfight, and that was my last one, because my wife said, either you go with the bulls or you go with me. So there were no more bullfights after that. And what caused this, her decision, I was pretty active and I could do pretty well. I was a Cape man and a Bandera man. But on this particular time, the Mexican boys, they kind of put one over on us. They gave I had the first bull to come out to fight. And they gave me one with real wide horns. And they kept the ones with the little narrow horns themselves. Well, that means when you try to put a Bandera on a bull with a wide horn, you have to get so close to him and you can't do it because he'll hit you. So as the bull came out, he stood out in the middle of the ring there, just a pawing, and I was just kind of scared to death because seeing those wide horns, like these other ones we fought had narrow horns. And when everything was just as quiet as it could be, my wife yelled at that, "Honey, get out of there." I yelled back. I said, "I'm sorry, but I can't move." So the bull came on, and I paid him with the cape. Then when it came time for the Bandereas, I could not stick both those Bandereas in him. So on my right hand, as he went by him on the right side, I hit him between the shoulder with one Bandera and hit him in the rump with the other one. When I did, they all hunted bandits and cowards, so the man that had in charge of the bullfight, master, I had to retrieve that lost Bandera and had to stick the bull back in the back again. And that was the last bullfight I took part in. Then after that, I came on to Robstown and we took over to Brendel Hotel. Then from there, we came out to the Corpus Christi Golf and Country Club. I was manager at the Corpus Christi Golf and Country Club for about 6 years when it was out on the old road from here to Robstown. And I had a wonderful time. The greatest thing that happened to me there was Dick Clayburgh and Bruce Klein and two or three other fellows, they framed me. Babe Beatrixon came to town, and she was in a heyday then, and which we all know was one of the greatest athletes, woman athletes ever born. So she came out there, and they came down, sent Rafael Martinez, one of my little waiters, down and said, "Tell Mr. Wally to come up here. We got a lady here from East Texas who wants to play golf, but she wants to play $5 a hole, and she wants to play with four men." So I said, "Well, okay. I hate to take her money." And I said, "Well, is she very good?" I said, "No, her name is Peggy Johnson. She's not too good." So and we got up there, and she said, "Now, I want to play you, Mr. Wally. Here's what the fellas are doing. They give me a stroke, one stroke on the long holes and a half a stroke on the short holes." Well, to make a long story short, after seven holes, I was seven down, which meant $35. In those days, we didn't have so many $35. So I asked Dick Clayburgh, I said, "Dick, that's what you do." I said, "Ring you out to presser?" He said, "Well, George, I don't know." He said, "I'm six down," and he's a good golfer. So we came to the eighth hole. I knocked a long ball and I sliced it out there. I hit at it as hard as I could, and she just outdrove me 50 yards. And she laughed, and I just kind of looked at her, and she kind of put her arm around me. She says, "Mr. Wally, do you know who I am?" I says, "No, but I sure as hell would like to know who you are." She says, "I'm Babe Fredrickson." I says, "You sick egg dog." I says, "Do you know I nearly ruptured myself every time I hit that ball?" That's exactly the word. After that, she spent 3 weeks with us, stayed at our house with the wife and my daughter and I. And she was just a wonderful person and a great athlete and just 100% lady. Now it's on. Yeah. Thank you. Another funny event happened at the country club, and a lot of the older members still alive know about this. We had a golf, we had a Calcutta pool, and we had a bunch of fellas came in from Houston and several fellas from San Antonio, which no doubt were professional gamblers. So we knew about it, and Mr. Martin Zurr, a personal friend of mine, was then president of the club. And he said, "George, what are we going to do to get these gamblers out of here?" And I says, "Well, I don't know." He says, we have to prove it, they're professional. So down on the big old rug, there, on the rug, there was a dice game going on. And I can mention these names because it came out in the local paper. And Jack Bonner and Maxwell P. Dunn, they agreed to take a fight. So they got down on the floor, and Jack Bonnerwood rolled the dice. Maxwell Dunn would take them and put them in his pocket and throw him another one. And Jack would say, "What's that for?" He says, "Bonner," he said, "those dice are crooked." Jack says, "They're not." He says, "Yes, they are." So they started calling one another the worst thing you've ever thought. So finally, Maxwell Dunn got up. He says, "Jack, you call me that one more time and I'll shoot you." And Jack called him that one more time, whatever it was. So Maxwell Dunn pulled a pearl-handled pistol and shot at Jack Bonner. Jack opened his coat, and we had put red ketchup all over his shirt. When he opened his coat, and all the rest of these three gamblers, they looked and they saw that too. And that was my signal to turn out the lights. So I turned out the lights, and Maxwell Dunn started shooting at random, just all directions. And when the shooting and everything was over, we had to replace six screen doors. There were six screen doors missing. The gamblers left. We never did see anything of the gamblers, and they came back, and we had a happy time right after that. I guess the most fun I've ever had in my life was fishing with one of my dearest friends, Clyde Douglas. He was a representative of the Globe Tailoring Company. I bought all my clothes from him, Billy Cox in Robstown, and then later from John Ferris here in town. Clyde was a great fisherman, excellent fisherman, but he would like to take a little nip. I wasn't much on the nipping stuff. So we'd go fishing, and we'd wait up, we'd go down to King Ranch, and then we'd go up to Ranches Pass in Port Aransas. I had a pass in the King Ranch. And we would go on these trips. This particular day, we rented a boat at Aransas Pass. It was just a little old rowboat, and we could row just a number of miles. So we rowed around the island, and coming back, while we had a whole string of fish, and Doug was, I think that half pint was all gone, but he took one more nip. No, it was a pint. I remember that. It was a pint because he had almost a half left. I let him drink it all himself. I wouldn't drink it. So I didn't have any water, that's why I wouldn't drink it. So as we were coming back, there was a bunch of flamingos blew up, and he said, "Oh, George, look at those beautiful birds." And it's the prettiest sight I ever saw in my life. Those red flamingos were on the fly, and the sky was blue, white clouds over there, and the sun was just setting below those white clouds. The most beautiful sight I've ever seen in my life. And he said, "Isn't that beautiful?" I says, "What?" He says, "Look at those beautiful birds, those pink birds." I said, "I don't see anything pink." He said, "Well, George, I swear they're pink." He took off his glasses and wiped his glasses. He said, "George, show them if they're pink." I said, "Oh, you're crazy. They're a bunch of seagulls." He said, "They can't be." I said, "Well, they are." So we rode along there in a little while. He said, "Well, George, what do you think's the matter with me?" I said, "Well, you got what they call a pink eye." He said, "What's the pink eye?" I said, "Everything white's going to look pink." He said, "Oh, Lordy." He said, "I got all these linen suits to sell them tomorrow." He says, "Will they all look pink?" I said, "Everyone will look pink to you tomorrow." He said, "Oh, my goodness." I said, "What caused it?" I said, "Whiskey." So he pulled out the flask and threw it way out in the water. So we rode about 5 more minutes. He saw a bunch of seagulls. He said, "Now, those birds are white." I said, "Yeah, you're right, they're white." And I said, "Well, for your information, those other ones were pink." And they were flamingos. He said, "Let's go back and get my bottle. Let's go back and get my bottle." I said, "Oh, no, nothing to do." Now, here's what I played with the peanuts. And there were a bunch of algae there. Of course, algae don't know much. But there were a bunch of Texas boys there, too. So here's what I played for the boys, for the Texas boys. To play the harmonica was Al Logan. His youngest boy is still alive in LaGrange, Texas. Al was 91 years old when my mother and dad married, and he wanted to go with Miss Emma. That was my mother. So my dad said, "Well, Emma, do you want to take him?" She said, "Well, he's a real good Negro." And he said, "Miss Emma, I don't want any money. All I want to do, just give me a little piece of land and let me sleep in the seed house." So that's exactly what they did. They had no room. Then my dad gave him 3 acres of land, gave him a mule, and they built a log cabin. So Al, he was self-sustaining, and he worked for the railroad and made 50 cents a day.
in Missouri, Kansas, and Texas were just building from Smithville to LaGrange. So he made some money there, and he worked for us, and he never did charge us, or else we never did pay him, but he never did money that was ever mentioned, but he always had enough to eat of everything. So he's the one that taught me to play the piano. Play the harmonica. You know, when you get 80 years old, these things can happen to you. So he'd come out back to the well there, and he'd eat his dinner. My mother would send it out. I would take it out to help. And he said, "Georgie, I'm going to learn you how to play the harmonica." I said, "Okay, Al." He said, "Okay, take it now." And he would take it up there, and he said, "Blow." And the first thing he taught me to blow was "Home Sweet Home." I'd blow, and he'd say, "Suck." And when I'd suck, he'd get snuff, you know. And I got all that snuff in there, saliva and that snuff in there, and it almost made me sick. I couldn't stand it. So my mother said, "You're not going to do that anymore." My dad said, "Not going to let him go ahead and let him do it." So I just kept on. The first thing I knew, I could play. And when I was 6 years old, one of the first pieces that I always wish to play, the name of it is "The Old Hen Cackled and the Rooster Laid an Egg." It goes like that. "Oh, the old hen cackled and the rooster laid an egg." That's a long time, so here's where we go. I went out to the hall to play the harmonica, and there was some old lady there, and she says, "Mister, can you play Gumdrops Falling on the Head?" I said, "No, how does it go?" "Oh, it goes da 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 da." I said, "Oh yeah, I can play Gumdrops Falling. It was Raindrops, so here's where I play it." It belongs to the United States. I said, "What belongs to the United States?" "This." He said, "I believe you call it Old Glory or something like it." And I didn't know what to play, so here's what I play. Jim Kern and Joseph Miller and I took a trip down the Padre Island. We went down 85 miles. We left Corpus Christi, went to Aransas Pass, got on the shuttle train, went over to Port Aransas, got on the ferry, then drove down the beach. When we got to the first pass, Shorty Stillwell, I think his name is Shorty Stillwell, had a little chalan there, or I call it chalan in Spanish, or I guess we'd call it a canoe or something. We'd run our boat on, and he would take us across. Then on the second pass, sometimes you could cross the second pass when the tide was low, but the tide was high, so it cost us 50 cents to go over a little rickety bridge. Then we drove down to the wreck. On our way down there, we ran into a bunch of muddy water, so we went 10 miles below the wreck, which made it about 95 miles. There at midnight, we were fishing, and something hit me, like knocked me over, and it had come in on a large wave, and it was a barrel. And the barrel evidently was full of something. We later found out what it was. So I rolled it on into shore. The rest of them said, "Oh, let it go," but I just strained myself because, you know, being a Dutchman, I wanted to know what was in that thing. So I rolled it ashore, and we found another one. The next morning, they kid me about it. They said, "Go on out there and get your whiskey." And so I took a wrench or something and knocked in the bunghole, and when they did, that stuff hit us in the face. and one of them hollered, cognac, and one of them says rum, one of them said whiskey. So we kept tasting the stuff and tasting it. Tasted pretty good, and the more we tasted, the better it tasted. So we loaded it on our truck and came on into Corpus Christi. And what it turned out to be, the barrel was marked HMS 1912. So it was no doubt it was put in the British Navy ship in 1912. And then during the war, a German submarine no doubt sunk this British Navy ship. And this barrel, how many there were, maybe several hundred on, those British drank a lot of that stuff. So it washed ashore. And we took it out to the country club, and I kept it there, and we divided it. We sent a sampler before we drank any of it to A&M, and it came back and said the report was 99% pure. It was just, they said they had never tasted anything like it. And that was due to the fact that for all those years, it probably was about 30, 40 feet underwater, we figured out, with some air, and it didn't sink to the bottom, and it was covered with oyster shell and barnacles, and that swaying motion or something like probably added to the strength or something. Anyway, it was wonderful stuff. Well, it came out in the paper, so I can't mention the man's name. He's still living, afraid it'd be one on him. But anyway, they sent out a customs man out to the country club to check into that, because they claimed that we had to have paid duty on it. So when the customs man came out there, he said, Mr. Wally, you owe a duty on that. And I think it was 50 cents a gallon duty. So that was 32 gallons. I didn't want to pay $16 in duty. So I said, well, all right, come on out and take a look at it. So I got the caddies out there, and we took all the liquor out and poured it in two tubs and put in some salt water with just a little bit on top. So when the customs man came, I turned it off. Boy, I'm doing this thing fast. Just thinking about that rum, you know how it gets. So the customs man put his finger down in that bung hole and tasted. He says, oh, Mr. Wally, this is just pure salt water. I says, well, he said, yeah, it smells like rum, I admit, and sometimes it probably was rum, but it's just pure salt water. So I said, well, okay, we didn't know it. He said, no, you don't know anything. He said, I'll go back and tell the old man about it. So as he started in his car, and I asked him, I said, I says, how much would this cost me? He says, oh, Mr. Wally, I wasn't going to charge you anything anyway. I just come tell the old man that there's no use there. He said, you found it, and you really don't owe the money on it. I said, wait just a minute. I'm going to give you the gallon of the best rum that you ever tasted in your life. And he took it, and he went on to town. And the rest of it, he divided up among some of the members of the club and Joe Miller Jr., who lives in the city at this time. The last report, which was about a year ago, he still had a little sample bottle of that. But it was just wonderful, and it looked a pale yellow, a real pale yellow. But it had lots of strength. One day they had a golf tournament down there, and there were two or three fellas wanted something to drink, and Mr. Clayburgh told him, well, this club don't serve anything. And he told me, he said, George, he's a friend of mine. He said, do you have any more of that rum you found? So I had to tell him the story, and I brought up a quart of that. So they drank it with a Coca-Cola, and I don't know what they call it, cocoa rum or something. Anyway, some of them even put ice cream in it and called it a black cow in those days. So they drank a bunch of that rum, and I told Dick Clayburgh, I says, Dick, those fellas going to get tired drinking it. He said, let him go. And this fellow says, this stuff doesn't have much authority. And Dick said, you just wait when you get to standing up, you'll find out how much authority it had. So when they stood up, they nearly both fell over, and we had to feed them back in the locker room, because they were too tight to feed in the main dining room, and we had to take them in the locker room. And rum just took effect, and you just couldn't tell it. It was strong, powerful, and wonderful, you know. You just couldn't tell it. I think this was in 1928. Things were real tight everywhere. Our golf course out at the country club was drying up, and we didn't have anybody much to take care of the greens. We had Blas Rodriguez and Luis Medina and Bruce Ward and I. But at night time, we would get up and We'd work all night long, watering the fairway and the greens, mostly the greens, to keep them alive. And we ran out of hose, and the club just didn't have money to buy in the hose. Mr. Moise Wild was president, and he said, well, George, maybe in a couple of weeks we'll get some rain, or he said, maybe we can, in the meantime, buy some hose. So these caddies had a bunch out there. They were always stealing apples from Mr. Kayla, oranges. So he'd come in the morning, and he said, well, Mr. Wally, they stole 3 dozen oranges, and I would pay him 25 cents a dozen. I don't know what I don't think he could have sold the stuff if he didn't want them, but anyway, I'd pay him 50 to 75 to a dollar every morning he'd come in. So I told these caddies one morning, I said, I'm sick and tired of you boys stealing these oranges. I said, if y'all want to steal something sometimes, why don't you steal some hose so we can water these fairways? And I walked off. The next morning when I went out to go to open up the club, I pushed my door and I couldn't open my door. And I said, well, what in the world's happening? And there was 3 feet of hose, 3 feet high. There was 22 hose piled up there. And so I didn't know what to do. I knew what had happened, that those caddies got those things. So I called down the city, but I was at the city limits, so I had to call the sheriff's department. They hadn't heard anything, and nobody reported anything. So after 2 months, I asked one of the caddies, Mr. Clayburgh's main caddy, I said, so, where did you get these hose, rats? He said, well, Mr. Wally, we picked nearly all of them up in Kingsville and in Bishop. Boy, when you get 80 years old, you get them AIDS on your mind, it's hard to get rid of them. In 69, we had a men's retreat at Lakey, and I went up with Bob Sally and Mr. Clemens, his brother-in-law. When we got to Pleasanton, we decided we wanted some coffee. So before we left, my wife had baked a bunch of chocolate cookies. So we brought those on into the place, and I asked the girl there. She's a great big little fat juicy Bohemian gal. She came waving on us, prancing around there. And she said, what do you all have? I said, we want coffee. I said, is it all right? Can we eat our own cookies in here? She said, well, sure, you can eat it. So we ate those cookies, and I put them down there. She said, they look good. And I said, yes. I said, have some. She said, all right. She ate one. She says, gosh, they're real good. And she yelled back, Selma, come here. You want a cookie? I said, come on, girl, eat the cookie. So they each took another cookie, and I turned around, and Bob said, George, these are good cookies. I said, well, and they were delicious. I said, but Bob, here's what gets me. I said, my wife's in bed with a smallpox. She gets out and bakes these cookies. Now, isn't that wonderful? It must be love. Those girls all put their hands in front of their mouth and started to the kitchen. And they came back, and they says, mister, honestly, your wife got the smallpox? I said, well, she's getting over it. But you bake these cookies? I said, yeah. My God, she said, don't you know what you can cost? You give everybody the smallpox. But then we told them different, and they were, and we gave them the rest of the cookies, gave them about 10 more cookies, but they were well satisfied. In 1968, there was up at Lakey, we had our men's retreat up there, and I was driving a little old Nash, and it could run anything and had 4 wheels. So I picked up Bob Sally, Zeb Carson, and J.B. Trimble. And we were going into Lakey, and I was driving around, well, I don't guess they could rest me now. I was going right around 80 miles an hour, going around the corners and stuff, and the cars in that time, that particular car, had the wheels kind of tilted. You could turn a corner, and it was just real easy. So, Bob says, George, just out running his car, I've never seen in my life. I says, well, it is. I says, but what I'm surprised at, I said, these tires, I've had these tires on here for 4 years. Well, J.B. Trimble and Zeb Cosmo were half asleep. They both jumped out, and like they jumped all over me. This is something that happened in 1900. That was the year of the Galveston storm. We were just about 60 miles, that is as the crow flies, from Galveston. We had winds, velocity up there to 90 to 110 miles an hour. We lived in a great big stone house built by my grandfather and the slave Alf Logan. This particular night, when the wind was blowing so hard, we had 2 great big old cedar doors, and we had a latch back of them. And the latch broke, and the doors opened. and that wind blowing 100 miles an hour and those great huge doors, it just blew everything around, the coal oil lamps, everything, but nothing caught fire. So my dad called the boy, called us two boys, said, "Edgar and George, come on, help me close these doors." So we put our beds in front of it and our dresser and the bureau, as we call it, and the sofa and everything to keep those doors closed. And it seemed to be it. This particular storm spawned a bunch of tornadoes, and they were all going around there. And a lightning hit about 25 feet from my house and hit a big cottonwood tree. Then the lightning hit again. So my mother opened the dresser drawer and took out some stuff that she lit and went around, walked around the house and burned it like kind of an incense. And I don't know what it is, but I've got a Catholic boy sitting right here. He'd probably tell you more about it than I could. But anyway, this was at Fayetteville, Texas. They had a square there, northeast, south, and west. On every side, they built an altar. And we were little kids. We had black suits on, and the little girls had white dresses on with a little white, pardon me, a little crown. So the priest would go there, and he would bless, he'd give an offer prayer, and then he'd bless these altars. And sprinkle the holy water over the cedar and the stuff what they were made of. And then I'd go to every one of those, and the women, all the women there, would break some of those cedars, and they would take it home, and they would burn it if someone was real sick, or if they wanted to offer a sincere prayer. And there's no doubt, I don't know how much it helped, but it certainly didn't hurt, because there are lots of them believe in it. And that's my idea about religion. If you believe in it, stick to it. So my mother, this now, particular night, she took that and she walked around the room, and as she was walking around the room, why, lightning hit just a few feet a mulberry tree and just split it wide open. And my mother was going around the room, my dad just looked at my mother, she was burning this incense, and she was crossing herself, and she was praying in German, and she was saying, "Vater unser, der du bist in Himmel, zu uns komme dein Reich, morgen gehen das wieder," and so on, the Lord's Prayer, she was praying that. Just by that time, another bolt of lightning hit a live oak tree, and it kind of caught fire. So my dad had all he could stand. He ran over and got that tin plate where she had the stuff on. He said, "Give me that doggone stuff," he said, "before you get us all killed and threw it in the fireplace." Well, for you four youngsters here, I don't know all their names, but they're wonderful youngsters. And they're brave, too, because I made a pie, and I told them they ate it, and they ate every drop of it, and they didn't even phase it, you know. Now, they were asking about living. Of course, I'm past 80 years of age, and I said, "Well, one thing, I never did try to make much money in the world. I could have. I know I've had the opportunities, but I was always seeking pleasure." And as I told these young folks, I think I've got more pleasure per square inch out of this world than anybody else. And my motto has always been, do the best you can with what you have. In that way, nobody can criticize you, and after all, that's about all you can do. And another thing, I'm a great believer in you are what you eat. If you don't eat, well, it's just like a gasoline or something. If you don't give the right kind of gas and a lot of gas, there's just nothing there, no pull. You have to eat a lot if you want to get around. And don't let yourself grow old. Stay young with the youngsters. Now this last song here, it was always played by Baptist Band in around 1905 and up to 1910, and it was beloved by all the Germans and Bohemians that came to this land. It is a polka, and here's about the way it sounded. Thank you. Here's a little episode that happened to my brother Edgar and I in 1903. We went to Beagle Dance, the Beagle Settlement Dance, and there they had the Butcher's Band. They were playing, and they were supposed to play there. When they got to the dance, the band didn't show up. So my Uncle Frank Cheadle, that's spelled T-S-C-H-I-E-D-E-L, Cheadle. He has his nephew here in town, Leroy. They got a wagon, and they brought one of those great big old organs. And when you turn that, you can hear it for 3 or 4 miles. It just has one great big roll to put in there, and then they set that, and it'll play the different kinds of music. So Uncle Frank, on this particular night, he was playing this organ. So when he started out in this big in this hall, the Germans would never dance with the Bohemians, and the Bohemians wouldn't dance with the Germans. Why? I don't know. They were the best of friends. We went to the same school, but they just didn't dance together. One end of the hall would be the Bohemian men, at the other end of the hall, the German men. The German and Bohemian men would all meet at the bar, they'd buy one another beer, but then they'd... Well, the, one of the reasons was the Germans talk German and the Bohemians talk Bohemian. So my mother told me, she says, I don't want you and Edgar to ever dance with those little Bohemian girls because they eat garlic and they smell like garlic. The Bohemian mothers would tell their girls, don't you ever dance with little old German boys because they're fast. You can't tell what they'll do. So that was what we were scared of one another, you know. So this particular night, they played one of these fast polkas, Uncle Frank did. And Edgar and I, we looked all the German girls for gone. They had danced with other German boys. And there were more Bohemian girls there. So I said, well, let's just dance. And I don't mind mentioning the girl's name. And then it's maybe still living. It was Tini and Mary Zapalach. They were twins, and they were wonderful girls. And they had brand new calico dresses. Edgar and I each had a brand new white linen suit that my mother had made for us that week. So there we were dudes. So we walked up to Mary and Tini. Said, you want to dance? And they kind of hesitated. And I said, come on, let's do it. And she said, all right. We went to school with them. So we danced. And Uncle Frank noticed it. And he knew what my mother, his sister, would do. So after he got through with that, he played it one more time, real fast. So we hugged, and we were good dancers. In fact, I still am at 80 years. I like dance for most of these youngsters. So we grabbed these little girls, and we held them rather tight, you know, and being at that age, you felt pretty good holding those little girls. They felt real nice. So we hugged them and danced. And when the thing was over with, we turned them loose, and I said, thank you, and they'd always thank the girl, and then we went back to our place. And Edgar looked at me, and he said, ha ha, look at you. There was the little teeny's red dress had faded all over my white linen suit. And I said, well, look at you, it's the same way. By that time, my mother spotted us, and she just waved us, wiggled her finger, like this, see, can you know what I mean? come on over here. She said, what I tell you? We said, we know, and she says, all right, you go out and sit in the surrey until the dance is over. So we had to go out and sit in the surrey until the dance was over. So the dance was over about 2 o'clock, and we had to drive about 4 miles. Then we, when we got home, we went to bed, went upstairs. Now, early in the morning, just before sunup, mother said, Edgar, Georgie, bring those suits down here. We went down the creek and washed them. We lived right near Wallace Creek, with a beautiful little running stream. There are rocks and water about 2 inches over those rocks. So she got some laundry soap that she made herself. She went on down the creek with her. We went on down there and washed her suit. We put that laundry soap on that red stuff, and that water came down there, and right below us was a little hole. It was full of minnows. That's what we always call it, the minnow hole. And when that red water hit that minnow hole, those minnows jumped all directions. They didn't know what was coming down there. So we had to wash those suits there 3 or 4 times and wring them out in clear water, and then we hung them up on the line. And every 15 minutes, mother called, all right, get in your suits again. We had to get in those suits because we had to stretch the trouser leg and we had to stretch the arms, because if we didn't, they would shrink up and they wouldn't even fit a monkey if we'd let them go. There's another funny thing that happened in this Beagle Settlement Hall. They had a ladies' room there, and they had double or triple bunks. Where they were young, where the young brothers and all of them would bring their children while they went out dancing, and they had netting wire around there so the kids couldn't fall out. They wouldn't go. Because at those days, the little kids and all of them dance on the same floor. They all dance together, the same thing. So they had some of them there that wouldn't go to sleep and just cry all night long. And my mother would make poppy seed cakes. We raised a lot of poppy seeds. And you fellas, or most of them know what opium is made out of poppy. So these seeds, these red poppy seeds, my mother would bake plain cookies, sugar cookies. Then she put a layer of sugar and a layer of poppy seed, a layer of sugar, a layer of poppy seed, and another layer of sugar on that, and then brown it all over. And when those little old kids didn't want to go to sleep, everybody would say, bless my mother's heart, "Aunt Emma, got some poppy seed cake?" She said, "Yeah, go in there, there's a whole basket full." And they give it to these little old boys. The little old boy would eat that poppy seed, roll his eye, and look kind of like a parsley or something, I don't know. So his eyes would get shiny, and the first thing you know, that little old boy would go to sleep, and he wouldn't wake up until about 8 o'clock in the morning. So it was nothing else, but he was just doped, and he went to sleep. Oh. But that's the way they got the kids to go to sleep, just feeding the poppy seed cakes. Nobody ever got in trouble. Well, this in regard to a little set-to I had with Pancho Villa. Not personal, but way off. In 19, I think it's around 15 or so, when he raided Presidio, we had a man living at the Eagle Hotel named Mr. Hugo. Mr. Hugo could talk Spanish, write Spanish. In fact, a lot of people mistook him for a Spaniard. And he went down to some ranch, I think it's the Mangum Ranch or Pryor Ranch, down in there, check on some cattle. And while he was there, Pancho Villa came by with his men. And so he asked Mr. Hugo, Hugo was at the house, he said, we're going to take some of those cattle in the pen, and out there in the pasture. Mr. Hugo says, "Well, I wouldn't take those, they're all skinny. Take the ones in the pen here, they're fat," because he knew that he would probably be killed and he's got to get on the good side of Pancho Villa. So Pancho Villa said, "All right." So they took, I understand, 4 or 6fatted steers out of the pen and drove them up toward Presidio. And they killed them on the way, and they had enough beef, and they took Mr. Hugo as a prisoner. And Mr. Hugo was a good domino player, and Pancho Villa liked to play domino and checkers. So as Mr. Hugo told me, I forget whether it was either checkers or a domino, he would let Pancho Villa beat him. Once in a while he beat him one game, but as a rule would let Villa beat him. That tickled Pancho Villa very much. So they kept Mr. Hugo, I think it's around 2 weeks, 10 days to 2 weeks. So we got a petition in Eagle Pass, and I circulated it among some of the merchants there, and we all put in some money, and we wanted to send $5,000 to Pancho Villa to get Mr. Hugo back. But before we could do it, why, Pancho Villa had released Mr. Hugo. And since Mr. Hugo was such a good sport, he gave him a horse, gave him a bridle studded with silver, and gave him a saddle studded with silver. And he gave him 3 Indian blankets and a whole sack full of opals. So Mr. Hugo came back into Eagle Pass. And this particular night at the hotel, he was thanking me for carrying that petition around. And I used to play dominoes with him a whole lot. So he said, "Here, George, I want you to have it." So he gave me a blanket that Pancho Villa gave him, which is possession of my daughter in Fort Worth right now. And then he gave me a whole handful of opals. And those opals, I've always had those. And my daughter has a necklace made out of some of them. My granddaughter has some in the ring. And the rest of them, I don't know whatever happened to it. But that was my experience with Pancho Villa and Mr. Hugo. And I think Mr. Hugo's folks are still living.